Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black gone, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. You're listening to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense Nightly Broadcast. Tonight, brothers and sisters, we're going to play the clip that we tried to play last night, but unfortunately we had technical difficulties as we were in the field and couldn't get good signal. But as promised, we're going to continue to play the testimony from the grand jury court of public opinion, human rights mock tribunal that's been started. This is an international fact-finding, grand jury-style people's tribunal that's been conducted by attorneys, doctors, scientists, and virologists from around the world that are proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that the whole COVID pandemic was indeed not only biological weaponry, with the COVID virus in and of itself being lab-made and released into the population of the planet, but also the dirty scheme behind the lethal injection of the vaccines and all of the political and economic and wicked schemes of those that are a part of making this, having this horrific crime against humanity unleashed. So let's continue. Today we're going to play part six. We have a few more episodes. Last night they had the concluding closing statements, but we got part six we're going to play today. I believe it's going to go all the way up until part 10. Up until part 10 or 12. It just depends because we haven't even gotten a chance to dissect the testimony that just took place on Saturday. But without further ado, we're continuing. For the record, be sure to document, take notes, part six of the Grand Jury of International Human Rights Tribunal of the COVID pandemic. Black Power.
Good morning, good day, good evening, wherever you are. This is the fourth session of the grand jury investigation with a real judge, real lawyers, real expert witnesses, and real witnesses outside of the system. The last session dealt with the PCR test and alternative methods of treatment. We will have a brief summary given to us by Judge Rui in a minute, but this is just to inform you that last time we learned that there is no real pandemic, only a PCR test pandemic, and that the virus, which is out there, can be dealt with regular methods of treatment. Before we go in medias res, we will show you two videos just to remind us with what this is about. The first one shows one of the chief proponents of the so-called vaccines, Bill Gates, explaining how ultimately natural immunity is better than vaccine-induced immunity, and another video that shows a victim of these shots.
To kick off, actually, and get a bit of a scene setter from Mr. Gates, because this is, I know, a topic that you've spoken on again and again. You were ahead of the curve prior to the beginning of this pandemic. Where would you assess where we are today in beating COVID-19?
Well, sadly, the virus itself, particularly the variant called Omicron, is a type of vaccine. That is, it creates both B-cell and T-cell immunity, and it's done a better job of getting out to the world population than we have with vaccines. If you do sero surveys in African countries, you get well over 80% of people have been exposed either to the vaccine or to various variants. And so, you know, what that does is it means the chance of severe disease, which is mainly associated with being elderly and having obesity or diabetes, those risks are now dramatically reduced because of that infection exposure. And, you know, it's sad. We didn't do a great job on therapeutics. You know, only here, 2 years in, do we have a good therapeutic. Vaccines, it took us 2 years to be in oversupply. Today, there are more vaccines than there is demand for vaccines. And, you know, that wasn't true. And next time we should try and make it, instead of 2 years, we should make it more like 6 months, which certainly, some of the standardized platform approaches, including mRNA, would allow us to do that. So, you know, it took us a lot longer this time than it should have.
I just taken my first dose of the vaccine. On the 1st of December 2021, I took in the Pfizer vaccine, and I was in very fit health and condition. All of that changed the instant I took the vaccine. When I started this new employment on the 23rd of November, they instructed me and requested my green card to prove that I've been vaccinated. The only reason I took the vaccine was because of work. No other medical checkup was done prior to taking the vaccine. My left arm has been put totally out of use. From the day that I've taken the vaccine, the very same night, I couldn't sleep. And it proceeded to the next night as well. I put up with the pain and the agony for the two nights. But like on the third night, I noticed that it was deteriorating. The bubble started here. Initially, they started here. And then you could see they were developing. During that time frame, my hand was deteriorating and I could not use it at all. I couldn't bath. I couldn't look after, care for myself and groom myself. So I went to my private doctor. Upon examining me, when he looked at my hand, it was in a very, very bad situation. It ran all the way down to my pointer finger. And he by sight only, he diagnosed that it was shingles. He gave me something to help me sleep at night and a few pain meds. He also prescribed to me an antibiotic, also blood clots forming on my fingers and on my palm. Because there's every 2 hours, there's like a sharp pain that just hits my entire arm. And it's like a burning, it's as if when you get burnt. And I had to constantly run my arm under cold water to eradicate that pain. I don't sleep at night. My arm is riddled with pain. I'm constantly waking the family up. Even though the blisters have healed out, there's still pain of nerve running through my arm all the time. I've been not working since the 1st of December due to me not being there for such a long period. I'm so afraid I will never take another vaccine. I'd rather die, or I'd rather get the COVID. Maybe I'll survive. But this unbearable pain and this disfigurement of my arm, because I'm somebody that dresses very well and I'm very fashionable. Now with the scars that's going to riddle my body, I don't think I'll be the same person again. I hope this opens up people's minds and their intelligence, and I hope they do the right things for the benefit of their health.
Now that we've heard from the famous medical expert Bill Gates and one of his victims, we will very quickly hear from the real medical experts. But before that, Judge Rui de Castro will summarize the last session.
You're mute.
You must unmute yourself, Judge Rui.
I'm sorry. Good evening, everybody. Summary of day 3 of the grand jury investigation of the Court of Public Opinion, February 2022. Dr. Astrid Zuckelberger explained how the PCR test was introduced in 2020 as a diagnostic tool which had never happened before. Also, normally in pandemics, there is a patient zero, but there wasn't a patient zero in this so-called pandemic. Explained also that all attempts in the past for a coronavirus vaccine have failed because it mutates all the time. Mentioned the conflict of interest involving Drosten, since there were 3 payments from Gavi to the La Charité between 2018 and 2020. Stated that Drosten must have known PCR testing design and would produce a massive amount of false positives, so he should have known. He knew. Dr. Ulrich Kammerer explained how the PCR test works and why it is technically not able to decide if a sample which is found positive is it indicative of an infectious, contagious person. Even if performed under perfect conditions, can't be used as a gold standard and basis for non-medical actions intended to stop the spread of a virus, since all the active material is destroyed in the process of the PCR. The first WHO protocol from Christian Drosten is technically very poor. Explained about PCR tests with the Drosten protocol started to be misused as a diagnostic tool, and also how a bad PCR test design can lead to a massive number of false positives. Stated that it's first time in history that a molecular genetic test is used as a diagnostic tool, agreeing that the goal must have been to create false cases in order to fake a pandemic. Sonia Pekova explained the difference in genetic sequences between different waves during 2020, concluding that there were different viruses causing them. That would explain why the Drosten PCR test aimed since the beginning to 3 targets in order not to miss anything, so it would produce the required number of cases for required pandemic that he wanted. He explained furthermore that if you have a virus that is changing so much, it's not possible to use one single vaccine that was designed to against the original virus, which does not circulate anymore, which could lead to antibody dependent enhancement. Dr. Brian Ardis explained also many people were dying in the early 2020, which is related to the use of remdesivir, leading to a massive acute kidney failure, liver failure, and heart failure. John O'Looney, funeral director, said that there was in UK there was no increase of the death rate into 2020. Only after the starting of the massive vaccination, the death rate increased dramatically, when it was clear that many young people were dying from thrombosis. Dr. Shankara Shetty found very suspicious that the new so-called virus spread from Wuhan to the rest of the world, but not to the rest of China. Found weird that PCR tests started to be used as a diagnostic tool, and that the health authorities were saying asymptomatic people were able to infect others. Explained his medical practice in South Africa during 2020, treating patients that were showing an uncommon kind of pneumonia using hydroxychloroquine, which is used for a long time and has antiviral effects. This is a summary of phase 3. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now let's hear from the real medical experts. What is it about the vaccine? We've learned last time that no pandemic exists and that the virus can be treated by traditional methods of treatment effectively and safely. What is the truth?
If I can share my screen. Hello, everyone. My name is Alexandra Henrion-Code, and I will share my screen. Can you see it correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I, Dr. Alexandra Henrion-Code, Director of Research in Genetics and Director of Simplicima Research Institute, declare no conflict of interest. It seems that we do face an unprecedented problem, and I want to stress to start with to give more relief to the testimony you just showed, Rainer. That we have in the present database over 3 million adverse reactions that have been notified in the database of VG Access by the World Health Organization. This is unprecedented because if we gather all the deaths, for instance, took place only after COVID-19 vaccination, in comparison to all the over the 30 years of any other vaccines, they already account for over half of the deaths over 30 years. So basically within 1 year of those COVID vaccination, we've already reached over half of the deaths. The problem is actual, because no matter how the way we look at the data, talking with our world in data, we have an increase of the weekly confirmed COVID-19 deaths per million people that keeps on increasing, specifically all the more in the countries that do vaccinate at a high rate, and more so than in countries where the rate is difficult to assess, basically, because it's India and Africa, but the trend of the curve is just so obvious that we can only say that the vaccination is not the solution. I want to stress that the problem is not an anti-vax or a pro-vax problem, as it has been constantly presented to the people. The problem is to openly discuss our scientific knowledge and the gaps of this knowledge. And typically, we need to accept that RNA viruses undergo relatively rapid mutation, which can critically impact vaccination strategies. To take an example, I will take the ancestral Wuhan SARS-CoV-2 variant that is likely extinct. That is to say that we haven't seen it in Europe or in any other country. And this Wuhan variant happened to be extinct without a vaccine. So for the last 2 years, a sole answer to COVID-19 has been repeatedly offered to us, which was presented as the vaccine. Yet we have at least five issues with this presentation of the sole solution to COVID-19. One is that this vaccine were our unwary and unethical products. We all know, I hope, that they are still at the R&D stage, research and development. They are on those products were still in the research and development stage and therefore are still under clinical trial status. The second aspect is that they were presented as the sole solution with false and changing promises, mainly due to the fact that, again, there was this ongoing status of the clinical trial that would end in 2023. The third aspect is that they could be imposed to the world because they excluded any other treatment. Basically, we have this conditional existence of this emergency authorization that solely depends on the lack of any alternative treatment. So one can only understand why no other treatment were presented. The fourth aspect is that there was no assessment of the epidemic dynamics in terms of the decision of going further to vaccinate massively. And this is also something very important, as well as a defectuous pharmacovigilance because the issue was so big. And the last but not least aspect, the fifth one, is that there was a flawed risk-benefit analysis that would not take account the age, nor the disease status, nor the status of immunity, whether natural or even the waning one now, as well as the adverse reaction. With these five items of the background, we understand how this COVID-19 were imposed to us as the unique solution. I will go reverse. So instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I will quickly browse the fifth point, this flawed risk-benefit analysis, but we'll go later on in detail because those are concerned the future. The fourth point is the fact that there was no assessment of the epidemic dynamics. And this is important because normally when you do vaccinate a population, you try not to be in a replicative stage of the virus that will go beyond a certain threshold. And you don't want to be in the dynamic that there is an increase. In Israel, the black line here was the start of the vaccination campaign. And therefore, and after that, you got the strongest peak of death, COVID-19 death of the Israeli population. The same happened in UK, where it was actually more in the lower part of the dynamics of the epidemic, but yet, again, it was followed, the start of the campaign was followed by the highest peak of COVID-19 deaths. Same with Emirates. And with those three countries that were that took place quite early because they were the soonest to vaccine massively their population, they should have had a halt. The exclusion of any other treatment, we have loads of studies that do show other treatments, yet those were excluded just for the sake of saying that there was no other solution. These false and changing promises are important. The failed promises, those are typically the fact that those products were presented to us as a mean to end a pandemic. Instead of ending a pandemic, we can read, on the World Economic Forum, on the conversation in September 2021, that COVID-19 was likely shifting from pandemic to endemic. So this is a failed promise of the virus. The other promise was that it would be a weapon to eradicate the virus. Now in Bloomberg, last month in January, one could read that Europe was slowly starting to consider treating COVID like the flu, meaning to take medication and not suddenly rely on vaccination. So it was a failed promise. Another failed promise was it was a drug to protect from the disease. But we all know, and Bloomberg again published it, I think it was yesterday, that new COVID variants obviously did complicate the question of vaccine mandates because these variants cannot ensure the fact that those drugs will protect from the diseases. The other part that is important in these false and changing promises is that at no stage was the immune status taken into account. And this is a big issue. There is this very nice paper taking over 52,000 employees in the health employees that clearly show that whether you have been previously infected or whether you have been vaccinated, you have a substantial protection against the COVID-19, and that vaccination of previously infected individuals does not provide additional protection against COVID, meaning that all these passport imposed on the people on not taking care of their immune status are wrong. The first to end up with the first point, which was the unwary aspect of those products, one should know that there was sufficient data in the literature to have all the warnings to understand that any anti-coronavirus vaccines were never successful. No anti-coronavirus vaccines were ever approved in France, whether in animals or in humans. And this had led to scientists to publish this very nice paper early on, stating that independently whether you would fight against SARS, against MERS with vaccine candidates, you had an phenomenon with antibodies that were associated with a high inflammatory morbidity in all the preclinical models, and therefore obstructing their advancement to the clinic. So they bypassed this knowledge. They also bypassed the fact that this phenomenon was consistent across any sort of vaccine used. It was not a question of the strategy, whether an mRNA or a DNA or what kind of vector, but it was irrespectively of the type of vaccine an issue. And therefore, they were asking that if we were to vaccinate anyone, we would disclose to them the specific risk of worsening COVID-19 disease from the vaccination. The other part is that there were known warnings for the mRNA vaccine as well. As such, a little bit like the anti-coronavirus vaccine, no mRNA vaccines were ever approved worldwide for any disease in humans. And this, you see it very well in the literature, through reviews. Basically, when you unravel all the clinical trials in the past, except with the exception of COVID, they did not reach beyond phase two. The last issue that I want to stress with these unwary products is the fact that choosing spike in the design of all these vaccines, because no vaccine does not target spike specifically, were a big mistake for three reasons. One is that spike is known as a hotspot for evolutionary for mutation. All these little triangles that you get means that you have intense mutation in the spike. So now if you build up antibody against a region that keeps on changing and mutating, obviously you know in advance that your product may be very well outdated. The second part, spike is a hotspot for glycosylation. It is a little sugar that is added to the spike protein in red that you see. This is the virus, in red the spike, and this glycosylation are the sugar, meaning that the patterns of those sugar on the spike keep on changing, and this again will clearly make any sort of vaccination more than tricky. And the last part, but not the least, is the fact that they chose a pathogenic antigen that they did not try to attenuate or to inactivate, which is normally the case in vaccination. That is to say that the toxicity of this spike was remained. So the last part is the fact that we know now that there will be repeated boosting, repeated injection, and this is again, from our past knowledge, a critical issue because systemic autoimmunity appears to be an inevitable consequence of overstimulating your host immune system. To that, I will pass it on to Vanessa and Sukarit, I believe. I want to stress the fact that we face an unprecedented worldwide situation harming a few people, at least 3 million already, potentially endangering all of them, meaning billions of people, and likely future generations, with a lack of demonstrated benefit as compared typically to vitamin D, for instance, because they could have compared their strategy. So it is, I believe, our responsibility to stop at once this never-ending campaign, as the fourth dose has already been announced in Israel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alexandra. One question I have. You said no mRNA vaccine has ever been approved for humans. Is it correct that mRNA technique has only been used in cancer research and been used on patients who literally had nothing to lose, not on healthy patients?
Cancer and infectious disease, that was the different trials, clinical trials ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
And could you quickly say what the second step of the trials is? Because phase two, what does that mean for the audience who doesn't know what that means?
So it means that you have a number of critical steps that you need to reach in order to ensure safety that you can move forward into human, and those are like the preclinical issues, the preclinical stages that you normally have, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4. And because they were not successful, they did not pursue further.
So, but phase 2 means it's a...
I saw that Vanessa wanted to elaborate, I think.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good.
Any other questions Sorry, Dexter. Yeah.
Good day, no problem, Rainer. Good day, Dr. Arian Kot. I just wanted to find out, you are a geneticist. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. For how long have you been practicing as a geneticist?
I'm very bad with time. Since I graduated to my doctorate, so it was in 1997.
So 1997, that's definitely quite a number of years. We are talking more than 20 years approximately.
Over 15 years, 12 to 15 years on RNA biology, on RNA specifically.
Okay, so you will then say that you are an expert when it comes to genetics, you know all the ins and outs basically when it comes to genetics?
No, that's something very nice in our job, is that we never know nothing. And that we are always in the process of acquiring knowledge. So we are supposed to be a specialist, that is to say that we have a good knowledge of the literature, of a number of things, which is the stage at which the knowledge is. So it's never the truth, it's never something that is completely established, it is always evolving.
Okay. So when it comes to this vaccines, it is public knowledge. It is public knowledge that when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccines, we are talking about, and you have presented evidence, we are talking about the mRNA vaccines, which is then genetics. Or it is a genetic way of introducing new cells to the human body. Is that correct, Doctor?
Again, I didn't understand your point.
It is common knowledge that the COVID-19 vaccines, and you have given evidence that it is mRNA vaccines, which means it is a gene therapy. So it is then certain cells that is injected into the human cell, the human DNA. Is it correct if I say that?
I still didn't get your point. So it is correct to say that it is an advanced medicinal product based on gene. Some call it gene therapy. Even the FDA, I believe, has called it gene therapy. I am not comfortable with the fact it is a gene therapy, because therapy means that you are being cured of something. When here, in the current case, it has been injected in people who did not need to be cured, who did not mean to get treated. So that's why I'm not comfortable with this gene therapy. What it is that indeed you, by injecting those mRNA in the cell, what one cannot say that you do not reach a status of gene modification, because by this sole fact that this gene, viral gene, goes into the cell and to the best of our knowledge, we don't know yet when it gets degraded. But I think Vanessa, again, will elaborate on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you said that you are modified without, we don't know at which stage you cease being modified.
May I make a comment, Dexter?
You can briefly make a comment.
Yes. What Alexander was saying is actually that you are not injecting the body with cells. you're injecting the body with a viral gene, and the gene gets into your cells. So it's a big difference. Otherwise, whether you want to call this gene therapy or not is a matter of semantics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Thank you so much for clarifying it. Doctor, just before you go, you have also given...
I'm staying, so you, and I think you will get to know much more now.
Okay. You have given evidence, and your evidence, and for me, I actually regard it as very crucial evidence. And you have stated that no assessment of the epidemic dynamics has been done. According to you, how crucial is it for that to have been done? And so let me rather just stick with it. How important is it?
Crucial enough as to be in any books of any medical students in medicine. That is to say, it's the basics that you get to learn. You do not want to vaccinate someone when there is a chance he or she is sick or getting the disease. So you don't want to take the chance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So my last question to you, Doctor, is that, and I believe that you are aware when it comes to the four basic ethical bioethics code of medicine, and I am going to mention it to you briefly. The first principle, that's the four main principle of ethical principles. That is beneficence, and then we have non-malfeasance, autonomy, and justice. Now, having regard to the evidence that you have presented, will you say that any doctor who presents or actually injects any citizen in the world with this mRNA vaccine, which has never passed phase two, any of those doctors, are they in a breach concerning that four main ethical principles that I've mentioned? And I'm gonna quickly just beneficence, non-malfeasance, autonomy, and justice.
What is when they? It is their ignorance.
But when it comes to a medical doctor,
if you don't mind, perhaps we can add some points to for Professor Arnoncourt about the Nuremberg Code. It's about enlightened consent, and I think it's very important. If you don't mind, I will confront the scientific conclusions of Professor Arnoncourt with the principles which were determined in 1947.
That is
the Nuremberg Code of International... Yes, sorry, Dexter, can I go on? Yes?
Please proceed. Proceed.
Thank you. The Nuremberg Code of International Criminal Jurisprudence presents a list of 10 criteria. First is the following. The voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. This means that the person concerned must have the legal capacity to consent, that he or she must be placed in a position to exercise free power of choice without the intervention of any element of force, fraud, coercion, trickery, deception, or other unendered forms of compulsion or coercion, and that he or she must have sufficient knowledge and understanding of what is involved to enable him or her to make an informed decision. What it says is, consent with its irrevocability is the essential criterion for distinguishing from a criminal perspective between the victim and the subject. Professor Arnoncourt, in your point of view, can we consider that people injected with so-called anti-COVID vaccines have given a true an enlightened consent, following what you say?
Yes, I do.
You think that they gave a very an enlightened consent to the vaccines, anti-COVID vaccines?
No.
Do you think
they were not giving an enlightened consent? They were not enlightened, so they could not. So I think that there is the due to what I think was their ignorance, they could not, they were not in the capacity of informing the patients.
So they are victims. Because they cannot be subject of an experimentation if they didn't give the an enlightened consent, a true consent.
So basically, the victims are dual. The victims would be the medical doctors who a number of them who injected without having the knowledge, and the other where the victims are the victims themselves because they were not having an informed consent sufficient.
Can I quickly come in there? And I think this is very, very important, Doctor, is that we need to make this differentiation because you have actually defined two types of victims. The one victim you've defined is the medical doctor who actually inject this experimental mRNA in unsuspected citizens. That is then the first victim that you've said. The second class of victims that you've identified is then ultimately the patient per se. So what I want to get to, and that is the first class, I am of the view, and you can tell me as to whether you agree with me, is that when it comes to a medical doctor cannot plead ignorance under any circumstances based on the four ethical basic principles that I've read to you. And that is one of them, whatever they inject or whatever prescription they give, it must be to the benefit of the patient. So a doctor that has not done his or her research in any country of the world, injecting this mRNA, now we've got evidence it has never even passed the phase two, that doctor cannot plead ignorance and he must or she must be held liable. Do you agree with me on that statement that I've made, Doctor?
Not quite, because as I said in my presentation, I think we were facing an unprecedented situation. That is to say, the pressure of the medical doctors to do the job of injecting the people was so strong that I do not see how they could possibly or where could they possibly look for the information and because the information they were receiving themselves was not sufficient to get their information. That's why I really think that this is a very unprecedented situation.
May I, Dexter?
Thank you very much for that, Doctor. When it comes to, I'm taking note of you, Professor Bhakti. I'll come to you just now. So you've now clarified basically according to you, and that's basically then your evidence, and then the evidence it is unprecedented, so which means these medical doctors, in a sense, it is justified for them to be ignorant, although I will completely disagree with that because as a medical doctor, you actually put yourself out there to ensure that you look after the best interest of your patients. And it is your duty, even when it comes to pandemics and epidemics, any kind of illness, to actually do thorough research and then actually consult wherever you need to consult. And this is the problem what we have because everything has been top down from the World Health Organization the ministers and ministries of health in each and every country in lockstep. But what I just want to
I agree with you, but as I said, when you don't know where to find the information, where this is more critical.
I understand what you say. Thank you, Doctor. Just and I just want to put it on record because we do have evidence in this grand jury where a South African doctor gave evidence last week, and in his evidence, he explained to us what was the medical analytical process he underwent when he was confronted with this novel coronavirus. So then, in conclusion, seeing that he could have actually done that as a general practitioner, that's actually not from one of the main cities in the country, but he could have done that. So I will say, when it comes to a duty of care, the medical doctors, and specifically here, I'm actually making reference to Dr. Fauci. He's supposed to have known, and I'm talking about all the medical experts as well, also medical societies in each and every country. They were supposed to have known, and they cannot plead ignorance. But thank you for your evidence. I really appreciate it. In conclusion, Professor Bhakti, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I just want to say that what I presented was a little browsing, and the details are upcoming now with the presentation of Sukarit and Vanessa. So it was just meant to be a browse, so I took shortcuts into presenting it.
I just wanted to say that I would absolutely share your opinion about the responsibility of doctors to get informed, especially when they see that something is going wrong. Not perhaps at the very beginning, but after months of these deaths and injuries that we're seeing, no one can plead innocent. The only other detail I wanted to say is that this new vaccine has passed the stage 4 because of the manipulation of the studies. All right, so let's not make a mistake here, a formal mistake.
Thank you so much, Professor.
But the COVID, I said to the exception. To the exception of the COVID.
Exactly.
I think we should move on now. Thank you, Doctor. Yeah, we can move on. I'm done. Thank you very much.
Vanessa, would you like to go ahead?
Yes, thank you. So thank you very much for having organized this event. My name is Vanessa Schmidt-Krüger. I am a molecular cell biologist. And I think it is very important that we inform people with real scientific facts that the mainstream media obviously hide or do not know better. So with this event, basically, we want to show the public that there are also other opinions about the virus and also about the vaccination than the ones that the vaccination propaganda tells us every day. In my presentation, I will address 4 main messages, and after that, I will hand over to my wonderful colleagues. So let's start with the first message. What you should know is we don't need any vaccination against coronaviruses. So I have divided it 3 points. So point one is not nearly as many people have died from corona as the government and the media would have us believe. So the first thing what people should know is that SARS-CoV-2 is not a killer virus. This is also shown by the official statistics. It is only the media and the government that make basically a mountain out of a molehill. Now several countries, including the US, Italy, Sweden, have published that in far over 90% of the COVID-19 deaths, the patients suffered from several underlying diseases. These diseases damaged the patient's immune system to such an extent that these patients could no longer fight the virus as healthy people easily do. We would also like to emphasize here that the average age of death in connection with COVID-19 is higher than the average life expectancy. John Ioannidis, a world-famous epidemiologist, has calculated the worldwide infection fatality rate from an incredible huge number of publications and comes up with 0.15%. This number also includes people who did not die of COVID-19, but of other chronic or acute diseases, but who had a positive PCR test, but no COVID-19 symptoms. And we know from the previous session last weekend that a PCR test is of no use for clinical diagnostic. According to this knowledge, the infection fatality rate of 0.15% must be lowered even further. And just as a comparison for you, I would like to mention the infection fatality rate of cancer, which is 0.3%, which is double, and of cardiovascular diseases of 0.44%, which is three times more, and still people regularly run to fast food restaurants, even though we know that high sugar consumption is one major risk factor for these diseases. So our message here is, we do not have to be afraid of this coronavirus. So I come to the second point then, why we don't need any vaccination against coronavirus. We all have already a strong natural cross immunity against all coronaviruses, also against SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-2 is not a new virus. Whether a virus is novel or not depends on the genomic sequence of the virus. SARS-CoV-2 has 82% sequence identity at the nucleus level, so on the genome level, the SARS-CoV-1, the flu in China 2003. But much more important than the nucleotide sequence is the amino acid sequence of the proteins in the code of the virus, because these proteins are the docking sites for antibodies and lymphocytes. In fact, all proteins of SARS-CoV-2, except of two proteins, have 95 until 100% amino acid sequence identity to the respective SARS-CoV-1 proteins, and they also have equal protein 3D structures. This is important in assessing whether antibodies or T cells, which are already present in the body from previous coronaviruses, can recognize and bind these proteins. Indeed, only three proteins are of great importance, namely the three proteins that are embedded in the viral envelope. These are the S protein, so for spike, the M protein for membrane, and the E protein for envelope. Antibodies and lymphocytes can only neutralize the virus from outside. This means that interaction with these three proteins of the envelope is crucial. And precisely these three proteins of the SARS-CoV-2 virus are highly identical to the proteins of the virus from 2003. So we have 91% identity for the M protein, 96% for the E protein, and still 76% for the spike protein. There is a study from 2020 that compared all the cross immunities between proteins within the coronavirus family. In this study, the authors came to the conclusion that only 67% sequence identity needs to be present in the proteins for having cross immunity. And we have far more identity in SARS-CoV-2 and the important code proteins. I also want to mention that there are already 149 studies, and these 149 studies have confirmed that we have already a big repertoire on specific T cells and antibodies in the body against all human coronaviruses, including SARS-CoV-2. Blood plasma of individuals who were not infected with SARS-CoV-2 during the pandemic, and also blood plasma of individuals taken years before the pandemic, showed very good pre-existing cross-immunity in a multiplex assay that detected antibodies against different SARS-CoV-2 proteins. Even babies below the age of 6 months had already these antibodies in their blood plasma, most likely through breastfeeding. These antibodies in young children disappear, but the kids quickly come into contact with coronavirus during the time of flu each year, that in the end, at the age of 3.5 years, their children are already immune to circulating coronaviruses. Children need contact with SARS-CoV-2 as early as possible, so they can build up an immunity already from early age, which protects them by cross-immunity to new coronavirus later in life. If we lock the children away, we are changing the immune system in a way that nature did basically not intend. What we are doing to the children now, at least in Germany, is catastrophic. I want to come to the third point now, why we don't need any vaccination against coronaviruses. So besides the sequence, the high sequence identity, and the viral proteins, which our body already know. There's another evidence that we all have good cross immunity. The injection shows it. Infants who are still naive, so before the age of 4, mainly produce a certain type of antibodies after contact with the virus. These are the IgM antibodies. The amount of these antibodies reaches an optimal plateau at the age of 6 years. And there is, from there on is herd immunity. These IgM antibodies are not found in adults. Only very, very low levels, if at all. In adults, only IgG and IgA antibodies are produced after virus infection. And IgG antibodies are also the prominent type of antibodies after the vaccination. IgM and IgA antibodies are almost not seen after the injection. This is basically the final proof for a pre-existing cross-immunity and a re-exposure of the spike proteins to a pre-existing repertoire of memory immune cells persisting in our body. Within these 149 highest quality and robust scientific studies I mentioned earlier, which confirm cross-immunity, there is also a publication which showed a long-lived immunity. The authors of this publication state that in recovered patients from SARS-CoV-1 infection, 2003, still possess long-lasting memory T cells reactive to SARS-CoV-1 nucleocapsid protein 17 years later, as well as robust cross-reactivity to SARS-CoV-2 nucleocapsid protein. So that means natural infection caused long-lasting immune defense. The scientific evidence also destroys any narrative of the need for boosters. The pressure that you have to boost again and again because you can no longer find antibodies in the blood plasma is completely nonsense and contradicts any basic knowledge in immunology. So the body strictly regulates the amount of antibodies in your body. Antibodies always have a residence time of a few weeks, and then they are discarded from the blood. It would be a waste of resources when the body keeps the quantity of all antibodies always at high levels throughout lifetime. Therefore, antibodies are broken down after a while. What remains are the memory cells, which can react immediately and produce directly new antibodies when the pathogen arrives again. Keeping the quantity of antibodies high for years by regular booster vaccinations is absolutely nonsense. The narrative that people get reinfected as antibody levels in the blood drop is also wrong. People get infected because the vaccines cannot prevent infections. I will discuss this later in a section. So, for example, during the summer, there were just a few people infected because other external factors help the immune system, such as vitamin D levels, warm temperature, etc., but definitely not the vaccine. And while I am on the subject of booster shots, the second narrative for booster vaccination is also wrong, namely that we always need new boosters for a new virus variant. As I mentioned before, the three proteins, S, M, and E proteins of the virus envelope are relevant as docking sites for antibodies and lymphocytes to neutralize the virus. We looked at the amino acid sequence of these three proteins of the most relevant SARS-CoV-2 variants. Among them, there was the original sequence of the Wuhan virus from 2020, as well as the alpha, the beta, the delta, and now also the Omicron variant. The protein sequence of the M and E proteins of the original Wuhan virus are 100% identical in alpha, beta, and delta variants, and 99.something% identical to the Omicron variant. So, I mean, again, 100% identity. The spike protein is also 98% to 99% identical in all five variants. The current mRNA and DNA injections that trigger antibody production against the spike protein with the Wuhan sequence should also work against the spike proteins of all other virus variants. The problem is the vaccines simply do not work. And there is absolutely no need to adjust the mRNA sequence. No way. No vaccine that triggers antibody production in the bloodstream can neutralize a virus that comes via the air into the lungs. It cannot physiologically work. These vaccines can never work. I will speak about that in a minute. So basically, the whole thing, I think it's a big, big hoax. So in conclusion, SARS-CoV-2 is not a novel virus for me. The high identity in the protein sequence proves that. We know this virus already at least since two decades, and therefore we must and can rely on the experience and knowledge from already published data. We all display a very good and robust cross-immunity against SARS-CoV-2. Our immune system can easily handle this virus. We are not dying from the virus. Some people die because they have underlying diseases which weaken their immune system. They die due to a weak immune system. I think I make a break here, so and maybe there are some questions before I go for the next chapter.
Wait for the questions. Dear colleagues, let us ask our questions at the end of the witnesses, expert witnesses' testimony.
So I shall continue.
Yes, please.
Okay, then I come to message two, which you should know. The so-called vaccinations are inefficient and useless. So besides the already existing robust natural cross-immunity in us, which I just mentioned, the public should know that Pfizer has cheated. Peter Doshi, one editor of the famous journal, the British Medical Journal, published last year, major concerns about the trustability and significance of the reported efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine. He has criticized that conflicts of interest existed in the conduct of the phase 3 clinical trial. Three of four experts, the Pfizer personnel, who decided whether symptoms that occurred could be attributed to COVID-19 disease and whether the subject should therefore undergo a PCR test. This is of importance since it has emerged that the phase 3 study displays serious errors, including at least partial unblinding of the study. A very large number of individuals with symptoms in both the vaccinated and placebo group were excluded from the study for various reasons, and no one knows why. Also, the vaccinated persons received 3 to 4 times more medications for post-vaccination side effects than the placebo group. That means that these persons may have escaped the data collection as symptomless, although they had an infection. Numerous technical errors occurred in the study. So basically, that this study should have been declared invalid, as manipulations cannot be ruled out. So it is very questionable whether the high relative vaccine efficacy is true at all. The manufacturers used the relative risk reduction for its statistics, but this number is actually not relevant. Instead, they should have used the absolute risk reduction, which also includes the probability of being infected at all in the population. You must also include the number of persons in the study who do not get symptoms, but still get infected with SARS-CoV-2. So if we calculate the absolute risk reduction of the four vaccines, we are at a protective effect of only about 1% or below. 1% is not enough. Each vaccination is stopped below 50%. Also, very, very few positive cases were found during the study. The statistical power is practically zero. In a serious scientific work, these results would be meaningless and unthinkable to publish. For example, if only one person out of 20,000 of the placebo group gets sick, by chance or not by chance, and no person in the vaccinated group gets sick, then according to this strange logic of the vaccine manufacturer, we will get 100% efficacy. This is ridiculous. And the real numbers are not much higher. So the meaning of it, of this efficacy must be clearly questioned. So the point two is why the vaccines are completely inefficient. The lung has its own defense system against pathogens. It is very important to know that the antibodies formed outside the lungs and the spleen or lymph nodes after vaccination float with the bloodstream and can never reach the virus that enters the lung with the air. First of all, the antibodies in the blood cannot cross the inner wall of the blood vessels, which is lined with a specific cell layer. It's so-called the endothelium. This endothelium is the barrier. There are some organs which have holes in the endothelium, like in the liver. So, and there are also some organs which have small pores in the endothelium. This is, for example, in the glomerulus of the kidney and in the bone marrow for better blood exchange. But in all other organs, including the lung, this endothelium layer is continuous. There are no holes, so the antibodies cannot get out of the blood vessels and never reach the small air bubbles in the lung. And there's also a second barrier. It's the epithelium. So basically, you have the epithelium here, and if a respiratory virus comes with the air is here on the top, and then the antibodies are produced in the lung tissue and lymphoid organs here below the barrier. And basically, only IgA and IgM antibodies produced in the lung, and these antibodies can cross this epithelium in the lung and reach the virus. Why? Because there are transporters in this barrier which bind these antibodies and take them up, transport them through cells and release them on the other side of the barrier where the virus are located. And these two antibodies, IgA and IgM, are basically not produced in the vaccinated people. So IgM, almost nothing, you see nothing, and IgA very low, at very low levels. So the main majority, I think it's more than 90%, are IgG antibodies. But IgG antibodies in the lung tissue can never cross the epithelium, never, because there are no transporters for these kind of antibodies. So it's completely useless. So there are two barriers. So the vaccination produces antibodies with a wrong species, and there are two barriers which they cannot cross. So these vaccinations can never prevent infection or neutralization of the virus in these air bubbles in the lung. So it could be that some are saying, oh, it is proven that the generated antibodies after vaccination can neutralize the virus. Yes. But this is only possible in an in vitro experiment in an artificial cell culture system, never in vivo in a human body. So what you do in this experiment is you have a bottle of isolated antibodies and a bottle of the virus, of an artificial virus. Then you put the antibodies to the virus, you mix, and then you put it on a cell culture, so cell layer. And then you look whether it's neutralizing the virus infection or not. Of course, this is possible because you mix before antibodies together with the virus. But this never happens in the body. So this is all ridiculous. So in conclusion, the antibodies are absolutely useless to prevent any infection, and they cannot neutralize the virus in the lung. So should I continue with the next message?
We are, some of our experts are under pressure.
Okay.
So please give them a chance to tell us whether one of them or two of them need to be pulled forward in our chronology. Is anybody...
Yes, Rainer, I appreciate there's at least one other person who needs to be but I would like to, because I don't want to I'm not feeling great, but I would like to give my evidence.
Can we Vanessa, is it okay if we interrupt and allow Mike to interject and come forward with his testimony? We will come
of
back
course,
to you.
Yes, of course, it's a closed chapter, what I always say. Yeah,
thank you.
Excuse me. Just one question. Because Dina McLeod is also under quite time pressure. Like, how much more time do you have? Like, how can we balance this out somehow?
If I can go after Michael, then that would work for me.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Excuse me. Hello. Sorry, switch right here.
Yeah.
I had hoped that I would be coming up after Vanessa, but now I guess I'm going to be put off 1 hour, right? Or 1.5 hours?
I don't think it's going to take that long, Zuseri.
I do.
Oh.
Everyone is taking half an hour. And I cannot stay here, sitting here for another 2 hours. I will come back if I knew approximately what time.
I have a suggestion, and that's recognizing this is now the third time we use more time than we are scheduled, and I share Sukrit's frustration that I think to do a good job we should either capture more sessions or less witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see, actually Vanessa and I had, you know, it was sort of we're linked,
mm-hmm.
and Vanessa had started off with everything that would put me on on the road.
Okay, I mean, I don't mind if you are willing. If the Corona Committee is interested in recording another session, I would happily remain at the back of the queue and come another time. I don't think we should squash this up. It won't serve us or the public.
I think maybe we should schedule another hearing. Okay, let's do that then.
And then I don't need to ask any special favor and suggest that as long as you can handle Diana's concerns, I will, then you can leave me. We'll do this another time.
We'll do it at another time, Mike. We will reschedule then. Have another hearing.
Thank you very much.
But there was someone else, too, who has to go, right?
Tina. Yeah, that's me.
That's
Deanna
McLeod.
Right.
But I think she'll be okay if you go first now, Susharit.
No, Vanessa's not finished yet.
Mm. Okay, shall we then maybe also reschedule for Dina? I don't know. Like, what is your...
How much longer will it take you, Vanessa? How much longer will your presentation take?
Maximum 15 minutes. 10 to 15 minutes.
Oh, that's a long time, because I will need 15 minutes. And if then Arne Burkhardt comes, which would be very logical, he's going to need 30 to 40 minutes, I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. Ben, do you mind if we hear Deanna McLeod first?
When? Now?
Yes.
Okay. So, Deanna, she's going to need 20 minutes, 30 minutes?
Minus 15 to 20.
Okay. All right. I don't mind. It's okay.
Okay, let's go for it then, Deanna.
Okay. So, I'm up next then?
Yes.
Right now? Okay, fantastic. So, is the screen sharing capabilities activated? There we go. Let me just get to this. So my name is Deanna McLeod, and I am the principal and founder of a medical research firm called Kaleidoscope Strategic. I have a background in immunology and psychology from McMaster University, which is the home of evidence-based medicine here in Canada. I worked, my particular perspective is unique in that I've worked from in industry for 10 years in many roles in medical marketing and sales. And I became concerned at the end of about 1999 by a trend that I saw in pharmaceuticals where benefits were emphasized and risk minimized, both in how they conducted their trials, both in how they conducted their marketing and also their business practices. So in 2000, I launched and founded an independent medical research firm that was designed to help clinicians prepare objective clinical guidelines. So we provide research, medical research, writing, administrative support to help that. So what we're doing is we've worked with about hundreds of doctors in Canada to prepare guidelines in oncology, and we spend a lot of time looking at clinical trials and clinical trial design. And one of the unique perspectives that we have is we've acquired over the years an ability to see how pharmaceutical companies manipulate data. And so when I'm presenting, what I'm doing is I'm bringing our firm's many years of experience in preparing these guidelines to look at specifically the Pfizer phase 3 trial, and particularly the 6-month publication or the 6-month follow-up data for that particular trial. And I'd like to highlight a number of things that would make me question whether the purported reported benefits and risks are actually accurate. So moving on to that, one of the reasons why I'm choosing to look at the phase 3 clinical trial for the Pfizer data is that here in Canada, Pfizer is the backbone of all mRNA vaccines. And although there is also use for Moderna, it's much more limited. And Pfizer is the vaccine that's being promoted for children. And what I wanted to do, because this particular trial is the backbone trial, meaning that all the other trials are built on this trial, I wanted to make sure that in scrutinizing this data, it was that the benefits and risks were actually fairly reported. And so that's what we're going to get into. And in Canada here, one of the other things too is that there's a lot of discussion, you know, after this phase 3 trial was completed at 2 months, but with 2 months follow-up, and they began a mass vaccination rollout, they then shifted to observational studies. And observational studies being real-world analysis of data that basically said, you know, this vaccination rate is this high and our numbers were this, and we looked at COVID-19 cases, et cetera. But that type of data is actually fraught with bias. It is very difficult to interpret correctly. And so our firm basically sought to look at exactly the level one data, because that is the only way that you can actually create a causal link. So if you have an observational trial, you can say it's associated and there may be a benefit. But the only way to actually prove something in clinical trials is in the context of a phase 3 trial. And so proving efficacy or proving safety. And that's what we're going to look at today. So I know that my colleague Vanessa mentioned some of the strengths and limitations of this particular trial. But one of the things that I want to highlight is the fact that it was conducted in healthy individuals, which is not uncommon whenever you're thinking about a vaccine trial, because what you want to do is you want to treat the healthy in order to minimize transmission to the more vulnerable people in the society who might not be able to mount an appropriate immune response. However, if the vaccine or the purported vaccine, I'll call it an inoculation, is unable to stop transmission, then it actually isn't a vaccine and should be studied in actual population that it is meant to benefit. And in this case, the benefit of the population at risk was specifically elderly people in Canada in long-term care facilities, specifically with multiple comorbidities. And in addition, one of the things that we found when we did a Royal Commission report in Canada was that these patients were also had, the majority of them had documentation that said that they would have no medical intervention. So it's a wildfire where you have a disease that transmits through community spread. You have elderly patients who have no strong immune systems. We have under-resourced facilities, and we have a virus, and then we have people who basically have mandates that say no medical intervention. So you can imagine that in Canada, the death rates were very, very high. In fact, 81% of the death rates were in people who were in long-term care facilities. So studying a treatment, which we'll call an inoculation because I don't really think it qualifies as a vaccine, in a population of healthy people does not help us with a problem that is specific to long-term care facility transmission in elderly people who are immunocompromised. And again, I believe my other colleagues mentioned this, but the vaccine, the inoculation should have been compared to the standard of care if we wanted to prove something. And the standard of care was natural immunity and treatment. It was not placebo in the sense of somebody without any natural immunity. So we should have basically compared those two things rather than comparing it to a placebo. And based on the trial design, we cannot say anything about whether the inoculation is better or worse than natural immunity because they weren't compared. In terms of the testing, it's also been mentioned previously that it was selective testing. They did not systematically test. for the, they did not do systematic testing in the sense that they waited for somebody to be symptomatic, and then they were able to, they left it at the discretion of the investigator to actually test or not to test. And what that actually did was it created an investigator bias. And I think my colleague also mentioned the fact that they were taking treatments to lower temperatures that might have minimized symptoms. There might have been infection without symptom, which might have been compromised the efficacy endpoint in that regard. But they also weren't able to detect asymptomatic infections. And also they didn't use the standard virological test. So for instance, in our, when we're looking at clinical trials, we want to make sure that whatever test they're using to determine the efficacy endpoint is validated. And the standard for testing viruses is a virological assay, and that was not used. So when we look at a trial like this, we immediately begin to say, you know, is this a manipulated endpoint? And that's what we begin to question. Further to that, let me just keep going here. The endpoints for the trial, and again, I'm going to focus in on the primary endpoints because the primary endpoints are such that this study is actually designed to detect statistical significance in those particular endpoints. One of the endpoints was, of course, COVID-19 symptoms plus a positive PCR test 7 days after the second dose. And the second one was safety data. So the safety data, there were different forms of safety data collected. One was solicited, and that was the reactogenicity data. And they only looked at a subset of patients. They only tested that the reactogenicity in a subgroup of patients, not the whole trial. And they only did it for 7 days. And then they had unsolicited safety. So that means that a patient could say, you know, I'm not feeling well, and they would report it in an open diary, and then they would mention it. And if it was a severe any type of adverse event, unsolicited adverse event, that it would basically be recorded for 1 month only. And if it was a severe or a serious outcome, it would be reported for 6 months. So you can imagine that if you're reporting the endpoint, continuously monitoring the endpoint, but only measuring or monitoring the safety data for 7 days or 1 to 6 months, then what you'll miss is a lot of the safety data. And so there was minimal, there was inappropriate safety monitoring for this particular trial, especially when you're considering that you're using a genetic therapy in a population of healthy people. They also focused on clinical rather than subclinical endpoints. And when I'm talking about subclinical endpoints, that means that they didn't look at biomarkers and different factors. So they could have been looking at D-dimer levels, for instance, if they were suspicious that thrombosis might be, or thrombosis might be an issue. And the other thing too is that the secondary endpoint was severe COVID-19 symptoms. So although we're claiming that it reduces both COVID-19 cases and severe COVID-19 cases, the other one was a secondary endpoint, and the numbers of events were insufficient to actually establish causality. Finally, I'd like to talk about the fact that really what we want to be looking at is all-cause morbidity and all-cause mortality. All-cause morbidity means looking at you know, the sickness from the disease, COVID-19, as well as the sickness from the actual vaccine, both looking at the symptoms and the symptomatic burden for that, and also for the death related to that. And of course, the particular, the trial reported de-emphasized that and emphasized something that really isn't clinically significant, which is a symptomatic positive PCR test. And the reason for that is that the majority of those symptomatic cases were mild and really not of a concern. What we really needed to know was whether it was going to stop COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths in elderly people, and whether the all-cause morbidity and mortality was higher in the inoculation group versus the placebo group. So, and I guess the other final thing is, and we mentioned this earlier, is if it's going to be presented as a vaccine, then it would have to be, we would have to be able to prove that it stops transmission. And this was never part of the clinical trial design. And so therefore, anybody who's claiming that it stops transmission would be making false claims. Anybody that claims that it is reduces severe COVID-19 disease based on this trial would be, again, making false claims because the number of events weren't sufficiently high. And anybody who's making claims regarding lowering deaths, again, would not be supported by this particular trial. So I just want to emphasize the fact that after 2 months, we had a crossover, so there was an unblinding of the two groups, and when they were unblinded, people in the placebo group were offered the opportunity to cross over into the inoculation group, and about more than 80% of the people, I believe it was close to 89% of the people, actually crossed over. And what that means is that as of 2 months, we no longer have efficacy and safety data from a controlled trial. So all the safety data that we're going to be looking at, and that's the angle that I want to be looking at specifically, is really obfuscated by the fact that now most of the placebo group have actually been inoculated. And so when we present the data, we'll be looking at the unblinded phase, which was really only 2 months of the trial. And we don't actually get the full benefit of a randomized clinical trial to the point of 6 months, which is this data, because of this crossover. And I don't want to ascribe intent. However, there is a great benefit if you're interested in minimizing safety to have your placebo group cross over at a very early stage. Therefore, you will never be able to have a causal link to long-term safety issues. When it comes to efficacy, one of the things that we noticed in this particular trial report is something called combined efficacy endpoints. So one of the things in this particular trial, as they noted in the discussion, was that the immunity was waning at about 4 to 6 months in the adult population. And this is a publication that presents 6 months follow-up data. And in this particular publication, what they did, instead of reporting adult outcomes, as they should have, as a follow-up to the original two-month report, what they did is they combined the reporting of the efficacy outcomes of adults and adolescents. And the adult outcomes, of course, had 6 months of follow-up, but the adolescents had 2 months of follow-up. And by combining these two together, what they did was they boosted the numbers overall so that they could continue to report a 90%-ish efficacy rate. And that was likely due to the boosting of the younger adolescent group, which was basically only followed up for 2 months. So we actually, at this point, do not know what the efficacy at 6 months was for the inoculation in adults. That data was not provided in the particular report. So one of the other things that I'm going to do here is I want to compare. What we did was we pulled the data from the supplements and we compared it to how they were presenting the data for efficacy, and we used the same treatment using relative risk reductions and absolute risk reductions as Vanessa had noted previously. And we put them in one table so that you can compare the efficacy versus the risks of this particular vaccine by looking at it in one particular table. So here you'll see for symptomatic cases, which is again our primary endpoint, there was a net reduction in the number of symptomatic cases from the inoculation group to the placebo group. And there's our beautiful 91% efficacy. Remember that this is both adults and adolescents combined. It's not adults alone. And what that does is it provides about a 4% absolute risk change, which is over here, minus 4%. So there is a purported benefit, but if you're inoculating 20,000 people, a 4% benefit is not that great. It's not dramatic. Here it looks much better whenever you're looking at relative risk change, and that's why they tend to emphasize that, because that looks much more impressive than the 4% benefit that you're getting when you're looking at an absolute risk change, which is the number of people who are actually benefiting from the inoculation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just jump right here to the other primary endpoint, and these are all primary endpoints. So treatment-related adverse events, severe adverse effects, and serious adverse effects are all primary endpoints of this trial, which have not been mentioned to the same degree as the efficacy. And one of the things you'll note here is that in the inoculation group, the investigators ascribed adverse effects, which when you look at the reactogenicity data, are actually COVID-like symptoms, to 5,241 people who participated, and in the placebo arm, only 1,311, for a 300% increase. And if you consider that the absolute risk increase was minus 4%, that's the benefit there, the risk is plus 18% here. So there's more people at risk with this particular inoculation than you have people benefiting from the inoculation overall. When we look at severe cases here, you can see that there's a net difference of 22. This number of events is clearly not clinically meaningful. 22 difference is not, but although if you put it in a relative risk change setting, then it looks like 96%. However, there's only a 0.1% benefit overall to reducing severe symptomatic COVID cases. So again, an overemphasis by looking at the relative risk reduction and a very modest or minor benefit overall. However, when we look at severe adverse effects associated with the vaccine, we see that in this group, you have 262 versus 150. So that's a difference of 100 cases, severe adverse effect cases here, and an increase in 75%, and it's an absolute risk increase of 0.5%. So again, what we're seeing here, again, when it comes to severe cases and severe adverse effects, that you have more risk than you do benefit for this particular inoculation. When we look at serious adverse events, which are very concerning to me because we're treating very healthy people, and a serious adverse event as defined in this particular study is an event that requires inpatient hospitalization, is life-threatening, results in death or persistent disability. And you can see once again that you have more severe adverse events, 127 versus 116, in the inoculation group, which is an increase of 10%, and the incidence of these is about the same as the risk of many people in getting COVID-19 overall. I mean, it's small but significant when you're considering how severe those adverse events are. If we look at, so that's as close as we got to looking at all-cause morbidity versus benefit. And here, when we're looking at deaths, again, we went to the supplements table and we pulled the deaths, and these deaths are basically from the unblinded phase only, which means it's the first 2 months of the actual trial, or the first 2 months of follow-up from that actual trial. Because they crossed over, then it's more difficult to find out. But in this unblinded phase, the deaths were comparable, 15 to 14 inoculation to placebo. However, we have to remember that this is a very healthy population with their diseases that were controlled, with controlled disease. So to see this number of deaths in the placebo arm where they actually caught COVID-19 might be reasonable within a 2 month time frame in 40,000 people. But to see this many deaths when people are purportedly not getting COVID-19 but are getting inoculated is concerning to us. When we looked at the deaths after unblinding, you can see here that there were 5 deaths in the unblinded phase. Oh, sorry, excuse me. I'm missing a number there. There were 5 deaths in this case and 0 deaths in the placebo arm, for a total of 20 in the inoculation arm and 14 in the placebo arm. So again, just to be clear, after the patients who were in the placebo arm crossed over and received their inoculation, there were an additional 5 deaths, for a total of 20 deaths in people who were inoculated in this study and 14 in the placebo. Again, we have to consider that at least in this particular case for the second half, there were more patients who had gotten inoculated than the placebo group, but still this is concerning. This is not the trend that we would like to be seeing. And finally, if we actually look at COVID-19 related deaths, there was really only a difference of 1 death between the inoculation arm and the placebo arm. However, when we looked at cardiovascular deaths, we saw that there were 9 cardiovascular deaths in the inoculation arm and 5 in the placebo arm. So again, what we're seeing is if our desire was to see morbidity and mortality decrease in the target population, which was elderly people, what we're seeing in this particular study is an increase in morbidity in the sense of risk and mortality in a healthy population. And so we are very much familiar with cancer research, and if we ever saw something like this in cancer research, we would not even proceed with administering this to people who were in the end of their life. So these results are extremely concerning. And I'm just going to touch base very briefly on the companion trials that were conducted for children. And so one of the things that they do is they create a phase 3 trial, and then they basically do these companion trials where they, in this particular case, they're called immunobridging trials. These immunobridging trials basically were just focusing at antibody, neutralizing antibody titer production. And what they did, rather than doing a clinical trial, you know, if we were to be thinking about the people who were at greatest risk, it would be children. They're at no risk of severe disease. Therefore, what we would have liked to see is the safety being much higher, the much more rigorous, larger numbers of people enrolled, very strong endpoints like clinical, you know, subclinical safety, clinical safety, long-term safety, morbidity, mortality. We would have liked to see all of that. However, the trial that was designed or the endpoint that was used to approve these vaccines or these inoculations was non-inferiority of the neutralizing antibody titers, which what that means is that they compared antibody titers in people who were 12 to 15 years, and they compared them to antibody titers in 16 to 25-year-olds. So this study wasn't even designed to make any claims regarding clinical efficacy or safety, and anybody who makes clinical efficacy or safety claims based on this study is basically misreporting or making false claims. Again, they did the same thing with 5 to 11-year-olds, again, a slightly smaller dose, and they compared them to the neutralizing antibodies of 16 to 25-year-olds. And if you could note here that the number of patients or people enrolled in each of those two cohorts is very small. And so this is the basis by which we're moving forward with the vaccination of children. Now, they did, enroll 1,000 people in the clinical side of things and in the placebo side of things, about 1,000 in each arm. And these particular endpoints, unlike the main trial, are descriptive endpoints. So they're not meant to actually claim anything, but they do give us some sort of a window into, you know, the benefits and risks of the inoculation in this particular group. And I'm just going to very quickly move to this side because this is the absolute risk change, and this is the one that we really need to keep an eye on when we're looking at absolute clinical or clinically meaningful benefit. For symptomatic cases, it was minus 2%. So there was a reduction based on this. And if you can note here that it's really only a difference of 15 cases. And we also have to note that symptomatic cases in children are really not clinically concerning. So I would probably move to say that this is a clinically meaningless endpoint. Again, they're at no risk of severe disease. And of course, there was no differences in severe disease. So that's not a benefit for them. And however, if we look at treatment-related adverse effects, what we see is this concerning trend again, where we have more risks or more adverse events in the inoculation arm than the placebo arm. And I'm just going to emphasize this very carefully. The types of adverse events that were reported in the placebo arm and the inoculation arm are very similar, and they're clinical symptoms. They're COVID-like symptoms for the most part, when they were reported, at least based on the reactogenicity data. To see more COVID-like symptoms in people being inoculated versus the people who are actually getting COVID-19, according to this particular data, is very curious. And again, that's a 1% increase in adverse events here. But when we look at severe adverse events, remember, there's no benefit here. And suddenly there's an increased number, although small, of serious adverse events in the inoculation arm for a 0.4% increase. And again, when we look at the serious adverse events, and remember that this means inpatient hospitalization, life-threatening, results in death or permanent disability, we have 4 of those in the inoculation arm versus 1 in the placebo arm. And how many patients or how many children that you know where they get, where you take 1,000 children and you treat them, that you would allow 4 of them to have inpatient hospitalization, a life-threatening event, results in death or permanent disability if they're at no risk of severe disease. So again, because this is descriptive statistics, we can't ascribe cause to the inoculation and say that it is causing harm. However, it certainly looks like the trend is in the similar direction at 2 months as the data was for the adults at 6 months. I'm just going to move very quickly to our wee ones, the 5 to 11-year-olds who are being inoculated. Again, no risk of severe disease, no episodes of severe disease, slight differences in the number of actual COVID-positive, symptomatic COVID-positive events or cases here. But we can see again here that in terms of any adverse event, it's 46 versus 16. So they're actually getting COVID-like symptoms more in the inoculation group than we are in the placebo group. And just on that note, what we would say if we started to see something like this where the symptoms were similar in both groups and you're getting more in the inoculation group than you would in the placebo group, we would begin to say, how rigorous or how reliable is the actual test that you're using to ascribe efficacy. I'm just going to whisk past this. This is a whistleblower report from the BMJ that basically questioned the integrity of the data that was going into this. Our firm is basically questioning the reporting of the data and the emphasis of the data. We definitely noticed some tricks in terms of trying to boost efficacy and minimize safety by underreporting, and also by using, you know, considering one was relative risk reduction, and then what they did with safety was they buried it in the supplements and they considered it as percentages. And the other thing too that we look at when we see this type of reporting is we immediately go to say, what are the conflicts of interest? Who conducted the trial and who wrote up the report? Because, you know, the conclusions for this particular report were that the inoculation was both safe and effective. When we took a closer look at, and with no concerns related safety, no new safety concerns, I believe is how they actually phrased it in the 6-month trial. And we would not agree with that conclusion whatsoever based on our analysis. And therefore we go to look at conflicts of interest. And it is notable that there were conflicts of interest, significant conflicts of interest in the majority of people who were involved in this trial, notably employment and stock for the corresponding author, the last author, and notably the two BioNTech founders who basically have earned $9 billion at the time when we made, you know, I think this was made early in the fall of last year. So again, have made incredible amounts of money based on this particular report. So we're trusting these people with these incredible conflicts of interest. And again, even the senior author, the lead author, S.J. Thomas, has had conflicts of interest. They've experienced grant or consultancy or clinical trial development. And notably also, and I just discovered this recently, is after the publication of this particular trial result, which basically boosted the Pfizer stock prices, the CEO of Pfizer divested of his stocks. And I, you know, again, this is pure speculation, but if I were an insider and I knew the safety data, and I knew the underpinnings of the safety data and what had gone on behind the scenes, then I would probably be concerned about people eventually finding out about this safety issues and might very well be prone to divest of my stocks as well. So my position is such that this trial should have never been passed, that there were issues it's hard to ascribe causality, but definitely there were tendencies towards overemphasizing benefits and minimizing risk, both in the manner in which that it was unblinded and crossed over, the short duration of trial, the short monitoring periods for the safety results, the questionable tests used for efficacy, and again, the emphasis on clinical benefit without really taking a very close look at the safety. And I would have loved to see all of the unsolicited adverse events to see what kind of adverse events they were reported. But again, all that they allowed us to see was COVID-like symptoms in both groups. And so again, I would say that that's an obfuscation of safety data and that that's minimizing the representation. So it would be difficult for me to understand how, based on the reporting of this particular trial, anybody could possibly say that they had informed consent when they agreed to the inoculation. Thank you very much.
Deanna, thank you very much for this devastating testimony. Let me just add one thing because we want to ask our questions at the end of this session. Your findings, your group's findings have been confirmed by a whistleblower from one of the companies or the company that conducted the trials for Pfizer. I believe her name is Brooke Armstrong, and we will delve into that in more detail tomorrow because this has significant economic impact as well. Their share price is dropping rapidly right now. Thank you very much. Who will be next? Susharit.
Continue, right?
Vanessa, mm-hmm. Listen,
if I could come in now and you could take it over afterwards, because you you have just given me, you know, a sort of the right starting point. Would you consent that I come in with my 15 minutes? I don't need longer, and you could take over from there.
No, it's fine with me.
Thank you, because time is running for me too. Listen, these have been very, very important informations and presentations. And I want to bring in another aspect, which is we don't really have to discuss very much anymore, because also molded in the Nuremberg Codex, if anything is under experimental use, if an experiment is ongoing, as it is right now, we are at the R&D stage, then whenever something happens that is a clear indication that that agent that is being administered to the experimental group is causing illness and death, it has to be stopped. And you must first delve into the question of whether it could be the reason. Now, we are not talking about one or two or three cases. We're talking about thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of cases of serious adverse events. And so, for this simple reason, if the propagators and the instigators of this whole vaccine madness cannot show that it is not due to the vaccine, it must be stopped on the spot. Now, we have heard from Vanessa that the vaccines could never work in the first place, and they don't work. And we don't have to ask whether protective antibodies, so-called, are being produced or not, because they're not playing any role in preventing infection. That's what we're witnessing all the time. So let's not go off on a tangent and stick to the point. If there can be no protection, can there be any damage? And there, of course, the answer is, of course, because these, I'll talk about the mRNA, although the adeno vector vaccines are similar, these so-called vaccines have two toxic components. One being the envelope, the packaging, and people should be made aware of the fact that these lipid packages have never been tested and passed for safety, never been tested in any animal or human model. And yet, although they are only chemicals that have never received license for use in humans, they are being used on billions of people. These people who continue to do so have to go to jail. There's no other way, because these lipids are now known to be highly inflammatory. They are similar to one of the major bacterial toxins and killers of mankind, the so-called endotoxin, which is the cause of the cytokine storms when you have a bacterial infection. And these lipids do the same thing. This has been published and shown, and there's no doubt that when one injects people with these vaccines, you are putting poison into the body, poison that causes severe illness and death in animals. And this cannot be allowed. Apart from these lipids, which have many pathways to injuring you, we have the gene of the virus itself encoding the spike protein. And that can lead to harm via so many mechanisms. But the two major categories will be, first, the spike itself, when it is produced by your body cell and released by the body cell, is a poison. The spike itself is a poison. Now, this is something that people Now, no, it wasn't known, you know, 5 years ago, but now we know it and it's published. And so you cannot inject an agent that causes the production of a poison. It's ridiculous. Second, when this spike starts to be produced, the cells producing the spikes are going to be attacked by the immune system. This is a fact. Everyone knows this. Anyone who studied medicine must know this. If they don't know this, then they must be stripped of their, they have to be prevented from practicing medicine. They have to. There's no excuse for not knowing this. So we have basic mechanisms that are straightforward, and of course they must occur. The systemic effects are predictable, and when we predicted them 1 year ago, it was no big deal because there was no other way they were going to work. The only thing that one had to assume was that these substances would enter the bloodstream, enter the circulation, well, it would go to the lymph nodes and then enter the circulation. And this is the first major lie that everyone was confronted with by the FDA, the EMA, the producers. The agents would stay in the muscle. But anyone who studied medicine must know that if you inject something into the muscle, it's going to reach the lymph nodes. And anyone who studied medicine must know that if something reaches the lymph nodes and it is not a protein, it will reach the bloodstream. And that, of course, was known. Pfizer was forced to reveal these data to the Japanese authorities who asked for them. And it's all there for anyone to read. And now it's all there for anyone to read who knows about human medicine, because it's now been proven that the spikes appear in the bloodstream, and lo and behold, they don't appear for 1 day or 2 days. If they appear in the bloodstream, the producing cell must be touching the bloodstream, because there's no other way for a spike, which is a protein, to reach the bloodstream unless the producing cell is not directly in contact. This is something so simple, so elementary in medicine, that if a doctor says, I don't know this, he's got to get his license taken away. Now, what happens if we know that the spike is in the bloodstream? We know that the mRNA has reached the circulation and in all probability has reached the lining of the vessels, which are the endothelial cells. That, of course, will create a focus for vessel damage. And that is what we said 1 year ago. It's got to happen. You've got to get vessel damage. What will happen then? The vessels will leak. What will happen then? If the vaccines are still there, they will leak into the tissues, into the heart, into the lungs, into the liver, into the brain, into whatever you want. And if those cells begin to produce the spikes, they are going to come under attack by the immune system, because this is what the immune system is trained to do. And as Vanessa told you, we all have killer lymphocytes that have been trained over the years to kill those cells that are producing the spike. So you are going to get vessel damage. Where this damage occurs, if there's a God, he knows, we do not. Because it's going to be haphazard, probably in the small vessels where the blood flows slowly, so there's lots of time for the cells to take up these damned substances and produce them. Small vessels, probably. You know, the vessels in the brain, these sinus vessels, the veins in the brain, there the blood sometimes is almost stopping. Or in the heart, you know, when you have the heart beating, with every beat, there's a pause where the blood stops to flow. So of course, those are the predilection sites where these packages are going to be taken up. And those are the organs that one would think are going to be hit. The same, by the way, for the spleen, because the blood flow in the spleen is complicated, it's known, but you have very slowly flowing blood there. Now, what will happen? You will be getting damage to the blood vessels that will cause blood clots. This is also what we said a year ago. We are goddamn worried that these clots are going to form in the whole body. It may form in the brain of one person, the heart of another person, the liver, who knows? Because this is what one calls destiny. It's destiny. Now, the brain is especially fascinating because the brain is full of small blood vessels going through the whole brain, keeping your brain cells alive, gray cells, white cells. And the tiniest disturbance can lead to death of nerve cells. And the death of nerve cells, depending on where these cells are, can produce anything, anything you want to think of. Of course, the whole thing may just start with a headache, splitting headaches, which are the typical symptoms that about 50% of everyone getting the second shot complains of. But it's only headaches are already the first sign that clots are forming in the brain. But, you know, if you're unlucky, you start to get palsies, nerves are falling away. The eyes start becoming unseeing. The ears don't hear anymore. People start getting paralysis. Where that happens, no one knows. But there are other things that are going on. Dear colleagues, many people tell me that they are seeing psychological changes in people. The whole personality changes. Now, you know, we have our brain with the limbic system that is you. It's your person. You have been, this is the human being, God-given, if there is a God. I'm a Buddhist, you see. But I believe in nature and that we are all individuals. Each has developed during his lifetime to become what he is now. And this is all your whole personality, everything that is human is here. Starts there, it ends there. Your memory. So people are getting Alzheimer's. Some people are developing symptoms that are horribly similar to mad cow disease. You know, I don't want to go into this. I'm just telling you that the vision is so horrible, so horrible. Now, next and last, and then I'm finished because I don't, not yet. I told you that these vaccines must reach the lymph nodes, and it is now known that they reach the lymph nodes. It is known that the cells in the lymph nodes are going to die. Why they die and how they die, we don't have to discuss yet, but they will die. And the cells in your lymph nodes are the cells that are keeping you alive because they are taking care of latent infections in your body, viral infections, shingles, and blah, 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 tuberculosis in 95% of the world population of the third world. And I have the tuberculosis bacterium in my lung. I don't want to get that shot. My lymph node cells start dying, the cells that are responsible for controlling tuberculosis. This is what's going to happen, I tell you. And the same, not the same cells, but other cells are responsible for keeping cancer cells under control. Cancer cells that are arising all the time in our body, all the time. people who have had cancer have lost control once. They may be healed now, but they are also healed because their controlling lymphocytes are also there to keep the cancer cells that come anew get eliminated. And we're hearing stories all over the world of strange cases of tumors exploding into action into people. Very strange, isn't it? Now we know we're looking at an agent that has no benefit whatsoever. No benefit. Zero. But has the capacity over a myriad pathways to kill you and has been killing and is killing and is going to kill our children. How can anyone stand to see this happen? We don't have to talk about anything else. Look at the Nuremberg Code. It is, I think it's number 6. If there's any suspicion that an agent in the experimental phase is causing illness and death, that experiment has to be stopped on the spot. And this has nothing to do with consent. It has to be stopped. Now, I'm going to finish now. Listen, if this were a question of 1 or 2 days, you know, Pfizer's going to come, BioNTech said, yes, okay, the benefit is still greater than because the risk only goes on for 1 or 2 days when this mRNA is causing the spikes to be produced. And in fact, yes, there are cases where this has been acknowledged to happen. There have been a few cases, but they're so rare. Now, listen, you guys. You know that how long has it been, Vanessa, in the last 6 weeks or, no, 2 months? 2 months ago, this paper appeared that was so shocking that the spike protein can be found in the blood of vaccinated people for, what was it, Vanessa, 3-4 weeks? I don't really care. It was many weeks. And so we were asking ourselves, how can that be? Because we know that this mRNA has been tampered with to make it long-lived. But how long-lived is the mRNA? Question, answer, the answer has been published now in a paper called Cell. You know, Cell is one of these papers where you say, my God, it's something spelled. It's like the word of God. It's not fake. It's true. 60 days after vaccination, they could still find the mRNA in the lymph nodes of the vaccinated. They did not look further. But do you know what's happening to those billion people who have received this damn vaccine? It has been in their body creating the poisonous spikes that is killing people for at least 60 days. Now, I'm going to stop at this because I get so furious that nothing is happening. I get so furious. People are killing our children. And this, I'm afraid to say, looks premeditated. It looks premeditated. No one can say, I didn't realize this. Everything is published. Now, of course, the whole case would be closed if anyone could come and show that indeed these spike proteins are being produced outside the site of injection in the whole body, and at those sites you have immune attack going on and organ damage. And that is why this grand jury is going to maybe make the case, because we have Professor Arne Burkhardt, who's going to come tonight to show you that he has proof. The proof is there. The proof is there for anyone in the world to see. And once the proof has been shown in 15 cases, it's going to be shown in thousands of cases. And then, whoa, you protagonists and producers of the vaccine. And my prediction and my hope is that the stocks are going to plummet below the ground because they are going to go bankrupt. That is my big hope. So, Vanessa, I give the floor back to you. And then I think Anna Burkhardt is going to show you, you know, what Anna has done. I think I'm going to propose him for the Nobel Prize. That's what I'm going to do. Because he may be the person who is saving our children.
Thank you very much.
Vanessa, you want to go back? Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure because Mike said that he's not feeling well, but if he's still on the Zoom and if he can hear us, we should allow him to make his case because you just gave him the introduction. You suspect that this could be premeditated murder. Please, Mike, go ahead.
Okay, just give me a few seconds. I'm struggling to get my iPad to unlock.
Well, nice to see you back, Mike.
Thank you. Yes. This is ridiculous. I know how to get into this thing.
Take your time. Joanna?
Yes? I can't seem to... Oh, here we go. No, I'm okay. I found it. So, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So, you know, I'm well aware that there's been excellent testimony already. So just very briefly for the record, I'm Dr. Mike Eden. I've spent 32 years in the biopharmaceutical industry as a biologist, immunology, toxicology, biochemistry. I was 11 years ago or 10 years ago at Pfizer. And since then, where I was vice president, head of respiratory and allergy research worldwide. And I've spent 10 years in the biotech sector. I'm speaking out because, you know, as we're hearing this afternoon, these vaccines are very bad products. It's been established already that it's not necessary to have a vaccine, but I think it's worth making a point at a higher level because I know that the drug companies know this too. It's never appropriate to seek to invent, develop, manufacture, and distribute a novel vaccine for a respiratory pathogen of such modest lethality, even if it was a bit worse than it is. And the reason is by the time you've done all the work necessary to establish that it's safe, because that's the watchword for any public health intervention that you might give to billions of people, that's the most important thing. It's more important than efficacy. So in order to establish that that's true, it's going to take you longer than any plausible expectation of the length of time the pandemic will be around. So I know I only realized this recently, really, although we've probably already known it. But so what I'm telling you is, it could never have been a proper thing to do, what they claim to have done. Of course, they haven't actually done it at all. It's a fake vaccine, badly developed, badly designed, and so on. So that's an important point. That's...
One quick interruption. I think that was a slip of the tongue. You said of such modest lethality. I think you meant to say such modest efficacy.
No, I was sorry. Yes, no. No, I think it was because the virus is...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because the virus, it's not like it's flying Ebola. If it was 50% lethality, you would take different risk benefit. But for something only a little worse than flu, if that's true, you wouldn't do all these things. So that's... And we've also established it's not necessary. There are good treatments and so on. But nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, these vaccines have been made, these gene-based products. So we have to ask what was the intention, because it could never have worked. It could never have worked even if it was safe for the reasons Vanessa and Sukrit have outlined, but they've been done. So why was that? And there are various answers. One is just to make money, rip everybody off. I think for me, the dominant reason was this control grid idea that we've talked about before, that people would have to be vaccinated to qualify for a vaccine passport, which is a digital ID. But there's another possibility, though, and it was to establish in the public mind that these are legitimate products, so they could use them for other purposes. And though I won't extend my thinking at this point, I think it's quite obvious why they use these particular kind of gene-based products, because they're going to use them again, ladies and gentlemen. Quickly then, yes, on the safety... Just very quickly, these are an entirely new kind of medical intervention. Although they've cunningly managed to disguise them under the word vaccine. They bear, the only thing they bear in common with traditional vaccines is the word. That's it. There's no other similarity. And so when someone says you're being over cautious about safety, I will tell you that with any new class of products, in fact, every individual version of a product of any new class, you have to establish the safety in trials. People's opinions are worthless, including my own. But the onus is on the part of the manufacturer to prove safety, not for me to prove that it's harmful, although they are harmful. I think we've already talked very briefly about how, and I too actually state this, the design of these vaccines. So I'm a drug discoverer. I spent 32 years in R&D and in toxicology training. So I think I can state, and you can believe me, being in that environment, these are what I would call toxic by design. That is, if you were discussing it around a whiteboard in a research office, by the time you've agreed to make a spike protein-based genetic vaccine, you know exactly what's going to happen. These are not rational design. They couldn't work, and they would likely carry risks, and you wouldn't be able to characterize the long-term outcomes. But they did it anyway, and these are clever people from, you know, highly paid drug companies with decades of experience. So that the three faults are, one, it expresses spike protein that's already been talked about without any modulation of that biology. Secondly, the spike is, again, genetically the least stable part of the virus. Again, that was mentioned by Alexandra. Thirdly, and no one's mentioned this yet, it's the part of the virus that's least different from humans. You really want to pick something that's very unique to the pathogen and very different from you. Why? Because if there are similarities, familial similarities, then when you raise an immune response to this injected material, there's a possibility of autoimmunity. And in fact, I'm confident that that is occurring, and other people think so too. And I would say it's my opinion that the companies knew that spike was toxic, unstable genetically, and similar to many human proteins, with all the consequences that you would expect from that. Obviously, they're going to need to defend themselves, but I'm telling the general public that that's my view, and I've had it confirmed by other sort of veteran drug discoverers. What else should we say? Yes, and I think Secret and others talked about, in the design, there is nothing that limits how long the gene is transcribed to make protein. It could be minutes, hours, days, years. There's nothing about it that tells us how long that will happen. We can't just say, oh, it'll be okay. How long is it going to last? They were not required to measure it. They were not required to measure it because they managed to persuade the regulators, or maybe they were corrupt, that these are, quote, vaccines, and they were allowed to proceed down a development pathway that's relatively light in terms of obligations on the innovator, the drug companies. Really, it should have been classed as, I would say, a genetic medicine, where the obligations, rightly, are extremely onerous and would have taken a long time, and certainly would have included measurements of how long they are producing spike for and where in the body, to Sukrit's point, it's doing that. And they were not required to do either of those things. That's a catastrophic failure on the part of the regulators, who knew fine what I'm saying is true because it's conventional. I've never seen an exception other than in vaccines where you do not have to study what's called pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. So they haven't done that. It should never be done again, by the way. You know, Bill Gates was quoted recently as saying, we were a bit too slow. Mr. Gates, you're not a drug discovery person. I think I've established, and I can back up what I've said, that in order to move into a public health environment, that is to dose billions of people, the highest obligation is safety, not even efficacy. And you can only do that by treating very large numbers of people and observing them for a long time, not 2.5 months. It's completely inadequate. So his suggestion that next time we'll get it done in 6 months, you must not let him do that. It's a completely inappropriate thing to do, and it's almost certainly going to be harmful. Moving on just to manufacture. Again, earlier colleague, she's just left, but she gave a good account of herself in explaining that as the drug goes through, as this vaccine goes through development, it's necessary to demonstrate that you can manufacture the product consistently so that it is characterized as having in the vial what you say is in the vial. Now, the clinical trials was done with relatively low quantities of material because they were going to dose a few tens of thousands of people at most. But when you go into production, instead of it being a few tens of thousands, in total, it's going to be of the order of a billion doses. So this is orders of magnitude higher. What that implies, for people who don't know, is you can't use the same process for manufacturing the clinical material. It's going to be, you can't scale that up. So you have to start again and make an industrial scale process. When you do that, the stages required to characterize what you have made, that is the drug substance, the gene-based material, and then when it's been formulated, what's called then the drug product, those two steps, drug substance and drug product, require, I would say, roughly half of the entire workforce of an R&D-based organization such as Pfizer. I work there. Roughly half the people are involved in that later stage of synthesis, manufacture, characterization, or all of that stuff. And the reason they've got 50% of their resources over there is it's very, very complicated. So the idea that they manufactured of the order of a billion doses and got all of those processes stabilized, characterized, inspected, agreed by the regulator is for the birds. They did not do those things because it's not possible to do them in under a small number of years, probably at least 5 years. So what they claim to have done, a consistent manufacture, is impossible. And the regulators know it's impossible. And it's clear to people who've read the regulatory interactions between the European Medicines Agency and Pfizer, that's the one I've actually seen because someone leaked it, in November 2020, for example, the technical assessors at the EMA in Amsterdam had listed 7 what are called MOs, major objections, and they all related to the things I've just listed. They did not have control of the processes giving rise to consistent, pure material, and they didn't have control of what happened to it between manufacture and formulation in these lipid nanoparticles that Sukrit mentioned. 7 major objections. I can just to give you an example, when I was at Pfizer, if someone had filed or the department of company had filed a new drug application and even one major objection came up, heads would roll because it meant you'd not had a dialogue with the regulators so that, as to understand what was required by them. So to have 7 listed in November 2020 and then no more than a few weeks later in December of that year, that vaccine product was given conditional marketing authorization, emergency use authorization. So I'll leave the listeners to decide for themselves, given what I've said to you about complexity, and I'm in close contact with people who have analogous to me in research, have spent their whole life in that part of the pharmaceutical industry, is it possible that all of those major objections were resolved? No, it's not. So what they have issued and rolled out and had injected into people are materials which, from batch to batch, vial to vial, syringe to syringe, they've got no idea what you're actually getting. And I think that is probably a major contributor to the huge range of toxicity that we see in the database such as VAERS in the US. Some batches or lots are associated with 6,000 adverse event reports and some with a small handful. That's not possible to be due to differences in sensitivity, not across 1.5 million doses per batch. The average should be pretty much the same, and yet they're so different, there's got to be a reason, and the reason is it's not the same stuff in each of the lots. So I would say it's a criminal manufacture. The authorization by the European Medicines Agency and subsequently other global regulators, I think it should be investigated because I think there's criminal level of collusion and fraud to sign off these packages as suitable when they're absolutely, it's impossible that they were. And then we heard from other witnesses, and I would agree, they don't do the things that they're were intended to do. They don't protect you from infection or replication of the virus in airway or transmission. And I also am coming to the conclusion, looking at medical statistics, statisticians analyzing the data, I'm afraid it looks like what you see in the public domain is almost certainly data fraud at the country level. So in other words, you're being lied to even then about what these products actually do. I've got, I guess, what I've listed as critical miscellany, that is, there's a group of other things I couldn't quite make out into a separate item. It was never appropriate, although Bill Gates said it was, you will remember, the world won't return to normal, he said, smiling, until we've pretty much vaccinated the whole planet. The only people you would want to, assuming this was an appropriate route to protect people, and it wasn't, you would only want to protect the people who are at severe risk of harms if they're getting infected. And that would be people who are elderly, older than me, and ill, 3-4 concomitant morbidities, other diseases that are life-shortening. So why would you want to vaccinate the whole planet? Even if this worked, and even if it was completely safe, you would not do it, even down to the issue of money and medical resources applied to unnecessarily injecting, you know, more than once billions of people who are not at risk at all. So something is seriously wrong there. I'm mentioning it because people think it's an appropriate thing to do, and it's absolutely not. We've learned recently that people who have had certain viral diseases, it's probably been known and I never knew it, that if you survive certain viral diseases in childhood, it's associated with reduced chronic diseases in later adulthood, including certain cancers. So it is not, as suggested by the media, always desirable to evade or avoid infection. Honestly, if you're a young, healthy person, you're not at any meaningful risk of severe outcomes. And if anything, I suspect that getting the lifetime immunity from this particular rather bland virus for young people is actually slightly positive. And so it would be inappropriate. So why were they wanting to vaccinate every human being on the planet? Well, those of you who have been looking at this for a couple of years will know it's got nothing to do with public health. But again, it's this control grid idea. So that was that one. Yes, just quickly, if mass vaccination policies were really about public health, I'll just give you three quick examples of the kind of people you wouldn't vaccinate. One is if you've had the disease already and recovered, as that anaesthetist in the NHS, Steve James, I think his name is, he was arguing with the UK Health Secretary, Mr. Javid, saying, I'm not going to be vaccinated, amongst other reasons, I'm already immune having been infected. So it's a dangerous thing to do. It's not, oh, well, maybe you'll give them more protection. No, it's a dangerous thing if they already have immunity to the virus, including to the spike protein. What do you think is going to happen if you introduce into their body a gene sequence that will manufacture large quantities of the thing they're already immune to? Well, they'll get hyperimmune responses. It may kill them. So it's a stupid thing to do. It's reckless and unnecessary, since they're already protected by their own immunity, to vaccinate people who have been infected and recovered. And by now, if it really is as contagious as they say, after 2 years, who would not have encountered this virus by now? So it's over. We shouldn't be chasing people who are already immune. The second class are people who are young and healthy, probably anybody under 60, but certainly where it comes to children, it's just completely nightmarish that you would want to inject them. They're not at any risk, and so the risk versus benefit, it can never be other than negative. You will harm and kill children and save none of them. And the third group, I'm very passionate about this because I've followed the research myself, pregnant women. As I've said this before, since 1960 and thalidomide, everybody in the pharmaceutical industry, every healthcare professional, and I would say every pregnant woman, knows that you don't take anything you can possibly avoid. And if you have to take something, you really want to do the research and make sure it's proven safe in pregnancy.